My name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm here by the grace of God and the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. This has just been so exciting. I just want to thank the committee for the wonderful hospitality and the basket of fruit and the gifts and all these things. And especially you people that I've had the privilege to talk to on an individual basis today and last night. You really make Southern hospitality come to life down here. Thank you very much. But I was asked to come and tell you about my drinking, so I'll get right into that. I can wrap up my whole drinking history by quoting what the cat said when he got through making love to the skunk. He said, "I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand." So I guess I better tell you what happened in between. I was born in Spain and came to this country when I was 2 years old. And we moved into a WASP neighborhood where they hated Catholics and foreigners. And right there, my attitude that followed me throughout my life was formed in that I didn't want to be who I was, and I didn't want to be where I was. And so I decided right then that I was going to be the world's greatest dancer. You know, I learned that game of let's pretend right away. And so I was given dancing lessons, and I left home the day after I graduated from high school and joined what was then known as a road show or the end of vaudeville. And it was while I was on this vaudeville tour that we used to travel in caravans. And it was while I was on this tour that somebody passed around a bottle of slow gin. See, now, only the graybeards say, "Oh, yeah." See, they're the only ones that remember that because, you know, that isn't the end drink right now, you know. Which reminds me, you know, when I talk about slow gin, it dates me. And I've been thinking about getting a facelift. But, I mean, what's the point in getting a facelift when everything else is sagging, for Christ's sake? You know. I tell you, it's a sad day when you find yourself trying on one of those cross-your-knees bras. look at her, that young girl down there. She's laughing. You know, she's got the kind you can scratch a match on, and she's laughing. When do you get here, honey? I better get back to my drinking story. Anyway, this bottle was passed around, and I drank as much as I could, threw up and passed out, and that was my pattern the rest of my life. Now, I'm not going to say that I got drunk every day. I got drunk every time I drank. I was totally unable to predict my conduct from the very first drink. And so after we got off this tour, I wound up in the nightclubs of San Francisco as a featured dancer. And, of course, alcohol, booze was always right there for me. It was very available. You know, working in nightclubs as a featured dancer, you know, it's like shooting fish in a barrel there. You have all the attention of all the men, and got written up in the columns. Herb Cain in San Francisco used to call me the Belle of Bush Street. And, you know, you wear fancy clothes and wear a lot of jewelry and, you know, all the things that I thought were going to make me happy because I felt so unfulfilled inside. And yet I walked around and said to myself, "What the hell's the matter? Why am I not happy? I've got all these things and I'm not happy." And then I discovered that the reason I wasn't happy was because Hollywood hadn't discovered me yet. And that was, you know, that's the whole answer right there, because all this other stuff, it was just a step toward Hollywood. And the day came when they did invite me down and had to have a screen test, and I went down there with the attitude that Betty Davis start better saving her money, because I was on my way, you know. And I forgot to tell you, I was born scared. Anybody else? Anyway. And I got down there, and I took this screen test, and it was rotten. Well, how can you act when you're already acting? But I didn't know that about myself. However, they did sign me to a stock contract, and I don't know why it is, but this will come as no surprise to any of you who are alcoholic. I got attracted and drawn to the drinking crowd. I always did. I don't know what the magnetism was, but it was always there. And so as a result of that, I didn't do a lot of stuff. I didn't become the big star that I'd set out to be. You know, I just went to a lot of parties, and I went to all these places that you read about in the movie magazines, you know, Ciro's, Mocambo's. I became a party girl, a play girl. And there was, to me, though, there was something undercurrent about my drinking. There was always something sad about my drinking, but then I kept drinking to cover that up, too. And I went along, and I didn't do a lot in pictures. You don't notice me as a big star of any kind. But I did do some dancing, and I did do some acting a little bit and all that stuff. But toward the end of the second year on that lot, I just thought, you know, they're not going to pick up my options here. I just had a feeling that I wasn't going to go anywhere with this career. And just about that time, a man from the USO office came and offered me an opportunity to go overseas and entertain the soldiers because the World War II was on. I jumped at that chance because the first thing I thought of was all those men over there. Yeah, see, the gals know. I joined this little troop. There were four or five of us, and this first trip took us to China, Burma, and India. And that's where I met George. Now, if there's any of you other graybeards out there that resent USO girls for fraternizing only with the officers, I'm here to remove your resentment. Because I drank with Yardbirds, generals, it didn't make any difference to me. I just said, where, and let's go. Ask George. He'll tell you. Because George and I drank together over there in China someplace. I don't remember. They can't prove a thing, George. Don't say anything. Anyway, I remember, now this is long before I was alcoholic, but I came to someplace up in the Himalaya Mountains. I came to one morning, and you know, I couldn't move. I was paralyzed. And my roommate, who incidentally died of alcoholism when we got back, she went and got the medics because she saw there was something terribly wrong with me. I just wasn't moving. My eyelids were fluttering, she said, and that was it. So they came over and they gave me shots and oxygen with the medics came over and they gave me shots and oxygen and walked me around and got me on my feet functioning again. And you know, I blamed the altitude. I didn't even drink in Denver after that. I knew that I couldn't drink in altitude. You know, you got to defend your right to drink. For God's sake. So, I came back from that tour feeling very put upon because the military hadn't told us that they expected us to entertain between shows. Well, actually, they didn't demand that of us at all. I demanded that of me because I was one of those people that desperately needed your approval, and I didn't know how to say no to anything. And so it was that I just partied all the time. And one of the first freedoms I found here in AA is the fact that today I can live in a manner that's acceptable to me regardless of public opinion, and that's a long way for me to come. But I got back from that tour, and now I was offered the opportunity to go over to the European theater. And I said to myself, this time it's going to be different. This time everything's not going to go by me in a big gray haze. This time I'm not going to drink so much and not going to party so much. Well, you people have read my story in the big book. It's called Chapter 3. This time it's going to be different. And it was. It was worse. Because, see, I didn't know how not to get caught up in these things. And I may be the only girl that was, the only USO girl that was up for court-martial. Because, as I said, I could never predict my conduct once I took a drink, and I have to tell you about that. I was always madly in love, or recovering from love, and I don't know which I enjoyed the most, to tell you the truth. You know, when you're recovering from love, what you do is you get your chair up to a rain-swept window, and you turn that sad music on you, that, and you get the jug out. My favorite was The Man Who Got Away. Anyway, I used to love that bittersweet agony there. Did it a lot. But what I'm trying to tell you is that I fell madly in lust with this handsome lieutenant in Germany. This is after George. And, you know, here I was again in a big party some towns beyond where I met him in Germany. And I suddenly decided that I needed to talk to him. And you had to go by field telephone, which meant, you know, it takes a long time to make the connection. So I was sitting there trying to get through to him when this captain, who was also drinking, came over and asked me to go drink or play or whatever with him. And I just said, well, you know, I'm trying to get in touch with this love of my life, and excuse me. So I just about got through, and that captain took his thumb and disconnected this phone. And I said, "Captain, if you do that once more, I'm going to hit you." And he didn't believe me, see? So I just about got through again, and he took his thumb and disconnected again. And since I had the phone right here in my hand, I whacked him on the ear, and he was either so stunned or drunk or both that he didn't realize that the blood was gushing out of his ear and down his white trench coat. And God, when I saw that, I was appalled. And when he saw it, he screamed like a banshee and ran across the street to where the MPs were hostile, and they all came trooping over, and he pointed me out. And, you know, that's humiliating. I was ordered to appear the next morning at 10 o'clock. And God, you know, I couldn't imagine being sent home in disgrace, because I had seen one of the other girls do that. Sent home in disgrace, and I had to spend the rest of the night trying to figure out how I was going to get out of this one. Do you ever do that? So I decided that since there were 14 girls on this show, that I had an outside chance if I took two of the other brunettes with me. And I just had a feeling that probably this guy would not be able to identify us. I was hoping that was my only out. So we appeared the next morning at 10 o'clock as ordered. And that poor captain was sitting there, and he had a hangover that was coming over in waves. You know, you've seen that kind of thing. You can feel him across the room. God, for a minute I felt sorry for him. Just about a second I felt sorry for him. And the upshot of the whole thing was that he couldn't identify me. Now, I always tell that story for a reason, because in looking back, I am almost certain that he was one of us, and of course, I hope he found the fellowship, and that some night that I would be talking and telling this part of my story from the podium, and he will be in the audience. It might even be tonight, I don't know. And after the meeting, he will come up to me with his hand extended and say, "Mary, I'm the captain that you hit on the ear in Germany. And I'm going to let him make his amends to me." Doesn't that make you feel good? We weren't always wrong, you know. Even a clock that stopped is right twice a day. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know when this even started. I don't know where this feeling even started, but I had long since lost that glow, that thing that you get from drinking, and I just drank. I was getting no particular joy out of it or happiness or anything. I was just drinking out of habit, I suppose. I don't know what it was, but I did notice that I was terribly, terribly depressed, and I blamed my mood on the terrible things I had seen over there, the destruction and the camps and all this stuff. And I was just so depressed and restless and irritable and discontented, as the book says. Of course, I was born that way, but it became worse. It became worse as I went along. And I thought the only place for me is those nightclubs of San Francisco where I had so much fun. God, how much fun can you endure, for God's sake? So as soon as we got back to the States, I immediately went back up to San Francisco. And, you know, everything there seemed to have changed. Even my best drinking buddies, they all seemed different to me. And the whole town was different. I thought, God, what a terrible thing this war has done to people and things and everything. It seemed like somebody was turning the lights out all over the world. It just was so depressing, and I had no further ambitions to do anything, and it was just morose all the time. And I decided that since I'd been all over the world and done everything, the thing for me to do is to get married. So I carefully selected a victim, and it happened to be a bartender I couldn't stand, you know. Now, you know, I never hung around people that didn't drink, and he did not drink. But Ramona will tell you that every pot goes out and finds a lid that fits it, because this guy turned out to be a compulsive gambler. And I give you a clue as to what kind of a marriage we had. He gambled my drinking money, and I drank his gambling money. And I mean, that's a tense way to live, I can tell you that. But, you know, I was at a point in my life where, you know, I just, you know, I had never achieved a goal that I had set out for. Never did. Always came right up to the edge and never quite made it. And I decided I can't stand another failure in my life. And this thing is, I've just got to make this a success. So, you know, I didn't even like this guy. I don't know, you know, when you're drinking. I decided that I had to get him away from all the gamblers up there. And I'm quite sure that he probably thought, if he just get me away from all the drinkers, that, you know, we'd had a chance here. So we moved down to suburbia in Southern California. We moved to the San Fernando Valley. And now I found a drinking buddy right across the street, and he found some bookies up on the corner, and the race was on again. And I thought, God, I just can't stand this. I got to do something to save this marriage. So, you know, what the only thing you do is you get pregnant. That'll save it, won't it? So I got pregnant, and now this person, this woman that I was now going to be, I had it all decided. I was going to do things like my neighbors did. I was going to be perfect. I was going to be a perfect wife. I was going to be a perfect mother. I was going to be a perfect woman. I was going to do things by the numbers. Do my laundry on Mondays and hanging up on the outside and chit-chat over the back fence with the neighbors. And I was going to wear pink curlers to the market. And I was going to do all those things that those women were doing. I'd join the PTA and do all that stuff. And I knew, above all, that this woman that I was now going to be, this perfect woman, did not drink. So I went on the way. God, that chokes me up when I use that expression. Anyway, you know, I got real crazy I got crazier this time than I ever did drinking, I'm sure. You know, it has to come out somewhere. Because I became a compulsive housekeeper. And there are always one or two in the house, because I used to clean the corners with pins. And I had a pocket full of Q-tips that I got the underside of things with. And I also had a toothbrush in the other pocket that I got the lettering on the appliances with. And if the old man got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the John, his bed was made before he got back. Now, that's a tense way to live also, you know that. But I tell you, I was just crazy. I knew there was something terribly wrong with me. I just knew there was, but I could not help it. I mean, I could not help it. And you know, when that baby was born, it's a wonder I didn't boil him, because by that time, I was washing the walls with Hexol, and, you know, everything was so sanitary around it. God, it was just... Anyway, this went on for a while. I mean, just total madness. It just went on for a while, and until I found out I was pregnant the second time. Now, I hadn't planned that one. You know how that goes? You know, here I got the first kid's whole life mapped out, what he was going to be, what kind of clothes he was going to wear, what kind of friends I was going to allow him to have. I had his whole life mapped out, and here comes this intruder, for God's sake. And I knew it was my husband's fault. I knew that this guy was trying to keep me pregnant and barefoot and out in the country, and I couldn't stand it. And so I said, well, you know, to hell with it. You know, I might as well have a couple of drinks. So I went across the street and had a couple of drinks and got away with it. And then I did it again, and I had a couple of drinks, and I got away with it. Now, I wanted, this is specifically for you people who are new with us. For me or anyone who is an alcoholic to go out and get have a couple of drinks and get away with it, it's like a guy jumping out of the Empire State Building as he passes the 30th floor. He says, so far, so good. Yeah. And that's what happened to me. Because right about this time, my neighbor lady and I returned to my native habitat, which was the neighborhood bar. Oh, God, I love those bars. I tell you, I love that dark, unreal atmosphere with the tinkling. See, there's a bar drinker right down there. The tinkling ice and the piano and those guys telling me how sexy and desirable and gorgeous and intelligent I was, you know. I never drank with any common laborers, you know. I drank with the nuclear scientists and brain surgeons and, you know. I just want you to know I had a little class in those days. But anyway, you know, I could walk in there with a dollar and stay for 3 days, for God's sake. And you guys that are laughing were picking up my tab. Don't forget that. Right? These girls know. Anyway, yeah, see, that isn't what I wanted. That isn't the way I wanted my life to go, but I was powerless. And this went on, and I had the second baby, and my husband took a dim view of my activities, so he left me. Then he came back, and then he left me, and then he came back, and always with the promise that he wouldn't gamble so much if I didn't drink so much. And, of course, you know, neither one of us could keep our own promises to ourselves, never mind anybody else. And so it continued, and as the result of one of these joyous reunions, I got pregnant the third time. And I was outraged womanhood. I tell you, this guy, it was all his fault, and it just added fuel to my alcoholic fire. I just couldn't stand this guy. I just knew that, well, you know, I had resentment you could subdivide, for God's sake. And, accelerated my drinking. And for a while there, my mother and father used to come over while I was out carousing. And this time he left me for what proved to be the last time, right after my third child was born. And now I was free to do what I wanted to do and live the way I wanted to live, which was party, and that's the only thing I was born for anyway, just to party and have fun, and I didn't want any responsibilities, and I loved my children, but, you know, I was incapable of taking care of them. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, naturally, and so it was that finally my mother and father turned their backs on me, which was the greatest thing they ever did for me. And I had a neighbor lady that used to look in on my kids while I was out drinking. And even though this is what I wanted, this freedom I thought I wanted, all those things that happened to alcoholic women started happening to me in rapid succession. I remember coming to in an alley one cold gray dawn, sick and shaking and scared and wondering what had become of the great Belle of Bush Street. And I couldn't remember having been at this bar because I'd been into so much blackout drinking for such a long time. But I hope I never forget one Sunday morning when I was lurching down Ventura Boulevard, which is one of our main boulevards, and I was dirty and I was staggering and reeling and falling down because my knees could never hold me up. And I was falling against buildings, and I remember falling down in front of the Catholic Church when Mass was letting out, and these two little kids coming down the steps with their parents. And I hope I never forget the look in those little kids' eyes to see this drunken, dirty woman falling down and crying and biting back my tears and cursing myself under my breath and wishing to God I'd died on the spot. See, because I really didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be that woman because I really wanted to be a good woman. I really wanted to be a good mother. I wanted all those things, but I didn't know how. I didn't know how, and I didn't know about alcoholism. And so it was that these things continued to happen to me, and I will leave the rest blank, but I think you women will know what I'm talking about. And it drove me to drinking behind closed doors and drawn shades, and by that time my homicidal anger was at such a pitch that I just sat and drank around the clock and plotting how I was going to kill this guy who was responsible for all of this. And I really believe that, you know, in my madness, I believe that to be true. For some reason, during all this, I picked up the phone and called the North Hollywood Clubhouse. And it took me 2 years on this program to remember where I had heard about AA. And it happened 2 years prior to this call at a drunken brawl across the street from my house, and there was a red-haired woman sitting there drinking a Coke. And I hated women, especially those who didn't drink. And I'm sure that I'm, in my own inimitable fashion, I went over and asked her why the hell she wasn't drinking. And she said something to me about having found a better way of life and something about AA. And here it was, 2 years after this, that I was calling the North Hollywood Clubhouse, which reminds me that my responsibility is not to is to scatter the seed and not to demand that it sprout on the spot. Because this woman to this day doesn't know that she gave the message to me. I don't know whether she's sober. She certainly doesn't know that I am. But anyway, this young man answered the phone, and he said he'd be right out. And, you know, that's an unwritten rule in our area about man calling on a woman. But I'll tell you something. On the way out, if he had any romance in his soul, when I opened that front door, especially if it's downwind, you know, I had to give up bathing. One time I came to with my nose about an inch from the water. I knew right away that was too dangerous for me to do. So anyway, there I was, and he had the front page or the cover page of the Grapevine. It was the Serenity Prayer, and I thought, oh, that's a nice little prayer. See, I wasn't alcoholic, but I was pretending because nobody was talking to me. And anyway, I was standing there drinking. I was standing there in my moo-moo drinking from my cheese glass. And you gals ever drinking a moo-moo, I tell you, that's the most functional drinking garment you can have. I tell you, you know, you can sleep in it, and you can make the run in it, and you don't have to wear underwear. And, yeah, if you throw up, it doesn't show up too much either on the print. Yeah. That's what you call gracious living, see? But anyway, I was drinking this out of the cheese glass, this vodka, and he broke rule number two. I said, aren't you going to stop me from drinking? He said, no, go ahead. Well, God, that got my attention. Yeah, nobody had told me to keep drinking. So then he broke rule number two, as I say. He said, you know, you're an alcoholic. Well, God, that sounded rather scientific compared to what they have been calling me around there. So I thought, this guy is brilliant, you know. Then he said, would you like to go to a meeting? And I said, meeting? He said, yeah. I said, you mean there are other people that'll talk to me? Because, you know, a long distance was hanging up on me by that time. So anyway, he said, yeah. I said, okay. So I put my raincoat on, and I don't know to this day why I put a raincoat on. It was not raining. But we got in his car. Now, nobody here knows except Jim O over there how far it is from Encino to Chatsworth. And I tell you, it's miles. I mean, it is miles and miles and miles and miles out to the boonies. It gets darker and the hills get higher, and we just kept going and going and going. And I thought this guy was going to take me out and kill me. And I really didn't care. See, I had been a failure at suicide too. So I really didn't care. That was the state of mind I was in. And so we finally got to this little church, and there was a little school room behind it. And he said, you go and look in the window there, and I'll go park the car. So I got out the car and looked in the window, and I saw about 20, 25 people, and they were hugging and kissing and rubbing up against, you know, how we do. And And I thought, oh, my God, you know, it looks like another PTA meeting. And I didn't fit in there. I knew that. And besides, this, you know, you weren't alcoholics. Those people were not alcoholics. But anyway, he sensed that I was backing off, so he persuaded me to come to the front door and look in. And I went to the front door to look in, and he took his hand and shoved me in. Now, that's, he broke rule number three. That's promotion. That's not attraction, folks. And I was introduced to the first to the woman who was to become my first sponsor. And, you know, she represented everything I hated in women. She was soft-spoken, spiritual, well-groomed, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she spoon-fed my soul. I was very fortunate in being put in the middle of a bunch of real hard-nosed guys. Old-timers. I mean, they really were tough. I wish they had more of those people around today, I tell you the truth. But, you know, anything less, I would have chewed them all up because I was such a hostile person and mean. And anyway, my sponsor took me home that night. And in those days, they didn't say, would you like to go to a meeting tomorrow night? She said, I will pick you up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock and we're going to a woman's stag. And I almost threw up. I was too afraid to tell her I hated women. And so as she drove away, she said, and by the way, please take a bath before I pick you up. I thought, what the hell do they want from me, these people? Don't they know who I am, for God's sake? Anyway, it took me all day the next day. I really wanted, see, I left a half a bottle of vodka on the sink. And I really, everything in my body was screaming for just one drink. But I had heard something that night. At that meeting, the only thing I remember from that meeting that I heard was that any damn fool can stay sober for 24 hours. But I'll tell you what that first meeting gave me. I felt a power in that room that I had never felt before in my life. A power so strong. A power that I have felt in every AA meeting I've attended. A power that I feel here. A power of unconditional love, such as I had never experienced. In fact, if you just listen for a minute, you can feel it. I feel it now. I have always felt it. And so it was that she picked me up, and I went to this woman's stag. And I knew that I definitely did not belong in that group, because the woman who was leading that meeting was elegant. She had long blonde page boy, every hair in place, and she had an expensive little black dress with pearls. And she was sitting there so elegantly on her platinum ovaries that well, you've seen them, haven't you? You've seen them. And I thought, oh, my God, a toast burner if I ever saw one. Oh, God. I knew I wouldn't fit in there. But, you know, I think when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, because the next gal that got up and talked my native tongue, which was profanity. And you can bet I made a beeline for her right after the meeting. But my sponsor was, you know, she was very spiritual, and she wouldn't let me use that kind of language at all. And you know, I was very uncomfortable with her, and I have to say this because she was a wonderful, wonderful person and probably the person I needed at that time. But she was so spiritual and so soft-spoken and so angelic herself, I really got the impression she was trying to get me to reclaim my virginity for a while there. And I don't know, I needed that kind of discipline. But the thing was that I felt very stifled by her. And I started to lie to her, which is bad, you know. You're supposed to be able to talk freely. However, I just hung in there, and she only lasted about a year before she had to move. She had to move up north, and I got a I got another sponsor at that time, a guy that I had been following around listening to and somebody that I could really identify with as far as the alcoholism was concerned. And his name is Clancy. I guess some of you people know him. He's a tyrant, you know. He's a tyrant. However, he was exactly what I needed at the time. I started going to 10 meetings a week. This is when I still had my other sponsor. And, you know, I loved it. I couldn't understand what you people were talking about. I couldn't read the book because the words were up on stems. I had double vision. And I just pretended a lot, you know. In the beginning, I just pretended a lot. And I just loved every meeting. I just went to these meetings because I couldn't get enough of this feeling that I was getting from all you people. And so it was that my husband found out that I was going to AA, and he, in his own madness, started to call me and threatened to kill me and threatened to take the children and so forth and so on. And it was just driving me up the wall. And I was trying so desperately hard not to drink, and I was trying desperately hard not to feel this terrible, terrible homicidal hatred I had. And there was just nothing I can do about that. I finally called my sponsor, and I said, Rita, if he doesn't lay off me, I'm going to kill him. You know, I haven't had a drink in 3 months, but I don't care. I can't stand it anymore. I said, what am I going to do? She said, well, why don't you hang up? It never occurred to me, for God's sake. They used to talk to me in those simple terms, you know. So the next time he called, I said, I'm sorry, but you're upsetting my serenity, and I hung up real fast. And I kept doing that. I finally got word that he wanted to talk to me regarding the future of the children and so forth. And this is not to imply that we were going to go back together, but I was ordered to go and see what he had to say. And we became friends of sorts. At least he wasn't calling me up every day or every 2 days. And so I went along, and like I say, I loved AA, and I loved the people in it, and I really felt that I fit in and I belonged, and I just became very active right from the very beginning. And I was sober about 3.5 months when I got another one of his calls. He probably had a bad day at the races or whatever, I don't know, but it was that madness again, and he again threatened to kill me. And God, it brought up all that homicide I had in me again, and that was the night of the woman's stag, and I went screaming at the woman's stag, and I was just beside myself. I said, I can't stand it. I just got to kill this guy. And you know what that elegant lady said to me? She said, why don't you pray for the son of a bitch? My God, that's the last thing I wanted to do. Of course, everything's been the last thing I wanted to do, starting with step one. So, that night at the conclusion of the meeting, I started to pray for him. And I'll tell you, I didn't mean a damn word of it, but I started to pray for him. And I kept doing that, not that I believed it, but because they told me to. They told me to do that, and I did it. And you know, that praying for him did not do a thing, didn't change him a bit, didn't change him one iota. What it did was it changed me. It took the hatred right off of my shoulders to the point where I really realized how sick both of us were. And then one of those hard-nosed old guys came up to me and he said, I think it's time you make amends to this man. And that, you know, I didn't want to do that. I said, Roy, I can't do that. He said, that's what we do here. And so because he cared about me when I couldn't care about myself, I was privileged to make my amends to him just 2 weeks before he died of a heart attack. And I don't know what would have happened to me had he died when I hated him so much, but instead of that, I was given this gift, freely given this gift of forgiveness by those people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. And so it was that I was left with three small children, and we had been running a restaurant for about 12 years, and it was very, very deeply in debt. I mean, we were really in debt right up to here with the IRS. And so I thought, well, that'll get me off the hook. But, you know, those mean people up at that Chatsworth meeting, they said, no, you've got to make financial amends. You've got to get your life straightened. Now you've got a clean house. And so I had to run that restaurant. And I started running the restaurant and working like hell. Now, I tell you, this is my poverty period. I went through a long poverty period, and I question anyone's sobriety that hasn't been through a poverty period on this program. because I was pinching pennies, you know, and the women in the program were giving me clothes to wear, which I gratefully accepted, and the guys were seeing that my kids were taken care of and everything. But anyway, in the meantime, the AA people were coming into my restaurant and they were buying the sandwiches and coffee and so forth and so on. Pretty soon we started a meeting there. And then pretty soon we had a couple of meetings there. And then we had a few meetings there. And I'm here to tell you, at the end of the year, the IRS was paid off. The bills were paid. And those old-timers out there decided that what we needed out there at that end of the valley was a clubhouse. So we got permission from the landlord to let this little restaurant be a clubhouse, and I mean, you know, it's still in existence. It's called the Nest. It's the sickest damn club in the world. It is the Nest, and a lot of sick people came out of there and they got sober. And the reason it's so sick is because we always accepted the people that other clubs rejected. See, we got the sickest ones, but that's still there. In the meantime, I became queen of the coffee table. You know, I was pouring coffee and all this stuff, and then I fell in love with a spiritual giant. You know Joe. And I'm here to tell you that be careful of spiritual giants. I'm not going to mention his name. Don't ask him for a ride home, for God's sake, you know. But, you know, we realized very soon that we had both made a mistake. And I'll tell you, when you're queen of AA in the valley, it's pretty hard to admit to the people that you've made a mistake, you know. And I hung in there simply because I had too much pride to admit that it was a big mistake and, you know, tell everybody. I really fought it to the end. I just tried so hard to make it go, and it just didn't. So, but the difference between that and the other marriage was the fact that we didn't have to have any big quarrels and threaten each other and, you know, all that terrible madness. We just split and that was it. And so now I had to get a job, because I was still broke. I got a job in a hospital kitchen. I was supposed to be learning how to be a diet aide, but the dishwasher was the one of us, and from time to time wouldn't show up. So I found myself washing pots and pans and cleaning employees' toilets. And, God, I couldn't imagine what God was doing to me. Why he was putting me in this kind of menial job. Doesn't he know who I am? And don't they know who I am? And why would I be put in this job? And this was by the time I had Clancy for a sponsor, and I used to call up and cry and moan and complain and... somebody said, why don't you get down off the cross? We need the wood, you know. There's just no, you know, you're looking for pity in here, you're crazy, you know. But Clancy would say, well, you got another job to go to, kid? And I'd say, no. And he'd say, keep working. When God's ready to move you, he'll move you. And so it was that I continued on that job, and hating it, I went to work every day with clenched fists and gritted teeth, hating every minute of it, and, you know, went to a meeting every night and got involved in everything. And, you know, it took me a while to realize why God put me in that menial position. I had never been in such a menial place, menial job in my whole life. The day came when my oldest son, who made first-string varsity on the high school football team, invited me to go to his first football game. And then I knew. Then I knew why God had put me in that job. Because, you see, after all that stuff that I used to have, the jewelry and the furs and the attention and the write-ups and all the stuff that money can buy, I never had any of the things that money can't buy, those spiritual gifts that are provided here for free. Because this is the first time I had ever, ever experienced gratitude. I had such a tremendous sense of gratitude when I was walking into that stadium that it began to choke me. It was such a new experience for me to feel that kind of gratitude. And as I was thinking about it, I was remembering all those men and those women who made it possible for me to be walking into that stadium with my head up. In fact, made it possible for me to show up. Because you see, it could have been the other way around. It could have been that I could have been a disgrace and an embarrassment to my son. But instead of that, here I was walking into this stadium. And I walked in and I sat clear in the end zone and watched those kids warming up. And I thought to myself, my God, I could have missed it all if it weren't for those people. I could have missed it. And when they called his name out as a starting player, I broke down and cried because I could not contain that tremendous gratitude that I felt at that time. And it was that my second son followed in his footsteps. And I was out there every Friday crying. Anything worth doing is worth doing to excess, you know. And those boys have been, they have been such a blessing to me. I have to tell you about John. Now, John was drafted when that big draft came by, and they sent him over here to Columbus. Is that what it is? Columbia? Columbus. And here was his first time away from home. And I got a letter from him. He was so depressed. He sounded like he was suicidal. Excuse me. So I got in touch with George and some people, and they took him out and took him to some games and a barbecue. He told me to tell you that that's something he'll never forget as long as he lives. He is very successful in insurance. And he has a beautiful wife, and he's given me 3 grandsons. And I need to tell you that a few years ago, he and his wife decided to change their religion, and they became born-again Christians. And I went up to their wedding, and he has a magnificent home up there. And after the wedding, I went up. We went to the reception, and I was sitting there, and he came over and put his hand on my arm, and he says, "Mother, something I got to tell you is very important." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "You've got to be saved." I said, "Jesus, you don't know what it is to be saved." I hope I didn't offend any of you Baptists out here. But anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm watching these people swirling around there, you know, sipping their champagne. God, I looked at one of those women and I wanted to take that glass and shove it in her mouth and say, "God damn it, drink it," you know. Now, he's very successful, and he drove me home from a meeting one night where he heard me talk, and he said, "Mother, the next time you talk to those people, you tell them if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be where I am today." And I thought you people like to know that. My oldest son also is very successful in insurance business, and he has given me a grandson and a granddaughter, and both of my youngest grandsons are both candidates for San Quentin, I can tell you that right now. I could go on for a long time and tell you the spiritual gifts that you people have freely given me to make my life what it is today. I've never had a better deal in my whole life than this life I'm living today. I'm living like I never thought I could live. It's just fantastic. But I also must share with you my pain, because, you know, I am here to tell you that sobriety is not for the faint-hearted. Some of you know that. It is not for the faint-hearted, because my daughter at the age of 13 or 14 picked up her first drink, and the nightmare began. And I was to know those things that we parents know that have kids out there. Those visits to the juvenile hall, and those visits to the police department to sign APBs, those agonizing, terrible, terrible times when you feel so powerless and I really didn't realize that she was into alcohol and drugs. I really didn't realize that. I just thought she couldn't possibly be because, you know, I'm, you know, big AA. She ought to know, you know. But unfortunately, that was not so. But she did reach a crisis in her life, and she came to me and said she wanted to change. It was precisely at that time that God decided to move me out of that hospital, because the bank on the corner came and gave me an offer for my house. So it made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I decided, since the boys were away, one was in Corey and the other was in college, that I could pick up my daughter and get her away from all those bad people. And we moved to Honolulu, where I became director of a 12-step house for women over there at St. Francis Hospital. And we went along beautifully there for a couple of months, and she again started the whole pattern. It was a rerun, and I was just going crazy. And about that time, since there wasn't an Al-Anon meeting in that house, we started one. That's why first we had our little lady over here come over. And I thank God for those Al-Anon women over there. I joined the Al-Anon program. And they gave me the strength and the courage and all the things I needed to do what the last thing I ever wanted to do in my life. And that was, I had to take my daughter down to the Honolulu airport and shove her on the plane and tell her to get the hell out of my life. And I had to walk away as fast as I could, because I knew that while she cried and screamed, that if I stood there any longer, that I would once again take her back home, and once again it would be the same thing over again. And I knew that she was killing me and I was killing her, and I just had to tell her to get the hell out of my life. It came to pass that you ever notice it doesn't say "and it came to stay"? It came to pass that my supervisor gave me a week's vacation, and the first thing I wanted, of course, the thing I really wanted to do was to go up to Southern California and get some of that industrial strength AA that we have out there and to fill my own cup. And I went up there, and what I wanted to do is visit all those home groups that I had, all 10 of them, and see all the people. And I walked in on a SHOOP meeting on a Sunday night, and my daughter was reading chapter 5 from the podium. And I would like to tell you that from that day to this, she has never had another drink or used any more drugs. Unfortunately, I have no such report to make. And this is very difficult for me to talk about, because my daughter, after 2 years of sobriety in our fellowship, and she could quote chapter and verse from our book and 12-step calls like you've never heard, she made a decision to turn her life and her will over to the care of cocaine. And now the nightmare really began. Because after a few years, it became impossible to let her do what she was doing. And that is, she had had a small child, she had a little boy, and it was necessary for me to legally take him away from her and put him up for adoption. And I thought I was going to die. The pain was so great. The idea of sending this little boy out into the world and never knowing what happened to him again was more than I could bear. And I can tell you that in that month that I had him at home, that I wasn't working any program. I wasn't saying any prayers. I wasn't reading any inspirational books. What I was doing was breathing and crying. And the only thing that kept echoing through my head over and over and over again was what Clancy told me a long time ago. He said, there are some days you just hang on. Some days you just hang on. And that's the thing that got me through that period. It was the most heartbreaking thing. See, neither one of my sons at that time, it was God's will that they couldn't take him. I'm convinced of that now. And I am telling you that God did for me finally what I could not do for myself. Because as the result of my born-again Christian daughter-in-law, she had friends up in Sacramento in the military, Air Force, who had been married for 10 years and could not have children of their own. And God, they took that little kid into their hearts like you wouldn't believe. And you know, the adoptive father is a major in the Air Force, and I know that not only is he getting all the love and everything, but he's getting some of the material goodies too. And so God did for me what I could not do for myself. And as a bonus, a couple of years ago, God saw to it that she had her own little daughter. And so that little kid has got a little sister and a wonderfully loving, happy home. The woman that has adopted him has kept in constant touch with me and given and sends me pictures and calls me on the phone. And last year she invited me to go to Lake Tahoe where they were vacationing, because they were up here in South Carolina, in Charleston. And I got to see this little kid. And I'm known to him as Aunt Mary. So he is not out of my life. And so it was that God did for me. God did that for me. As far as my daughter is concerned, the only time I get good news about her is when she's in jail. That's the only time I know where she is. But when she's out of jail, she's down in the worst dope den of Santa Ana. She's down on the streets down there with a needle in her arm, doing what she has to do to get what she has to get. And I say to you new people, especially you young people, stay with us. Stay here where you are wanted and loved, where you're safe. Go to any lengths. We beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Take the book literally, because this gal had as much chance as you and I. As for me, you know, it's been a day at a time, a step at a time, and a prayer at a time. And I know that all over the world, over 1.5 million recovered alcoholics are praying for her and people like her. And I'm only one of the thousands in Alcoholics Anonymous that's living proof that you can stay sober with a broken heart. Everything I have, everything I hold dear today, was freely given to me by the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. But most of all, for teaching me to walk in the dignity of sobriety. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.